It is a great pleasure to welcome to Best Ideas 2021 returning MOI Global instructor, Jeff Stacey. Jeff is the founder and CEO of Stacey Muirhead Capital Management and has more than 35 years of investment industry experience. Jeff, you have been so generous with your time and your ideas with our community. Thank you for that. I truly look forward to this presentation as well. Before I turn it to you, just a little reminder of some of your accolades to our community. I know you're on the advisory board of the student-managed Ivy Value Fund at the University of Western Ontario, and also on the board of the student-managed School of Accounting and Finance Investment Fund at the University of Waterloo, and a member of the board of trustees at Parkminster United Church in Waterloo. And you have been giving back to this community for many years now, and I'm truly grateful. I'll turn it to you now for the presentation, and I'll be back for the Q&A. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, John, and it's my pleasure to be here today with everybody. I just want to return and extend my congratulations to you. MOI, the membership community that you've created is awesome in every way, and it's just a very valued, certainly research resource for me, but also a friendship resource for me. So congratulations for all you're doing to advance the craft of investing. So with that, I'll get started. Usual disclaimer, the good news, I'm not going to read it. But I thought I would just start by setting the page for us all, and so that we're all on the same page of how we go about identifying investments, long-term investments at Stacey Muirhead. And there's no special or secret sauce here. We look at three questions. Does the business that we're looking at possess outstanding business economics? Does it have honest and capable management? And can it be purchased at an attractive price? And we've just coined the acronym, great business, great people, great price. And I'm sure many of the membership community invest similarly. And just to break it down a little bit further before we get to my idea, first question, this is not intended to be an all-inclusive list, certainly, but we're looking for high returns on shareholder equity, really strong balance sheets with minimal or no debt, attractive margins, pricing power, brand recognition, of course, growing revenue and earnings over time, and consistent free cash flow generation. And then the things that we consider in terms of assessing management is, you know, we want them to think and act like owners. And the best way for managements to think and act like owners is to have skin in the game. Of course, we look for reasonable compensation practices, and where there's performance earnouts, we want to make sure they're measurable and understandable and reasonable. Of course, we're looking for demonstrated integrity. We want a good capital allocation record over time. And that also applies, obviously, share repurchases can be a consistent part of generating a superior value creation record over time. And then this last point, unique corporate culture. The more time I spend in the business, I've just found that the really great businesses have a very defined culture specific to that business, and it's unique. And it drives a lot of how managements and the organization behaves over time. And then, can it be purchased at an attractive price? We have no special tools. We're looking at, you know, price earnings ratios, discounted cash flow yields, the same as everybody else. But I just, this quote from Buffett captures me, and I used it last year in this presentation. Your goal as an investor should be simply to purchase at a rational price, a part interest in an easily understood business whose earnings are virtually certain to be materially higher 5, 10, or 20 years from now. So that's just by way of sort of setting the table so that we're all on the same page. My best idea for 2021, Fairfax Financial Holdings. So let's talk about this company. A little bit of an overview, and I'm sure this company is known to many of you. Fairfax is a global property and casualty insurance and reinsurance company, and of course, do all their own investment management of the portfolios, insurance company portfolios. Was founded in 1985 by Prem Watsa when he recapitalized the Canadian subsidiary of Markel Insurance. The corporate objective is to compound book value per share by 15% annually over the long term. And I would just say Fairfax is committed to transparent and complete disclosure to shareholders and certainly commend the annual reports to your reading and the annual shareholder letter to your reading. Prem does a good job in laying out every year the pluses and minuses of the business. It's based in Toronto, Ontario. So a little bit of just basic background on Fairfax and what it is. In terms of the insurance side, one of the things I really like about Fairfax is I think they've done just a phenomenal job at building up a global property and casualty insurance platform. And there's just a listing of some of their companies. Now, Odyssey, Allied, Crum & Forster, Zenith, and Brit and Northbridge are the core of the operation. But I just, you know, note Falcon in Hong Kong, you know, they're building up a presence in Brazil through Fairfax Brazil. Bright, for example, is a South African insurance company. So they've really built an interesting and unique platform of property and casualty insurance companies around the world. And then, like many companies in the property and casualty insurance world, and certainly similar to Berkshire Hathaway or Markel, they've built up a diversified portfolio of non-insurance businesses. And I've just listed some there. Down the left side, they own a controlling interest in a restaurant company in Canada called Recipe Unlimited, and Eastside Mario's, Swiss Chalet, The Keg, Harvey's are some of the restaurant brands underneath Recipe International. Of course, Fairfax India, a controlled subsidiary of Fairfax that's publicly traded, that invests in India, Thomas Cook India, Dexterra Group in the middle there is an interesting facilities management and modular housing manufacturing company in Canada. Up above, I have Helios Investment Partners listed. That's actually the logo for the Helios Investment Partners private equity firm. Late last year, Fairfax Africa and Helios entered into a transaction and completed a transaction where Helios is getting about 42% ownership in Fairfax Africa in return for contributing some of its fee structure from its private equity funds. And Helios in turn will take over the investment management function in Fairfax Africa. But just a real interesting array of non-insurance businesses. Just to give you some basic data on the company, at December 31st, the price was $340.94. I just want to note one of the peculiarities as we go through this presentation. I'm giving you everything in US dollars unless otherwise noted, because the company's accounting is in US dollars. The principal trading market for Fairfax is actually on the Toronto Stock Exchange in Canadian dollars. But that $341 share price I'm showing you there is in US dollars. There at the end of the third quarter, there was 26.2 million shares outstanding. So the equity market capitalization, $8.8 billion. Book value at September 30th was $442. And they pay a $10 dividend. So based on that $341 share price, it's a 2.9% dividend yield. So I'm going to take you through the three questions and try and highlight some data that'll give you a sense whether they meet or successfully meet the tests of the three questions. So does it possess superior business economics? So let me just start with the long-term track record. This is the track record, full year track record to the end of 2019. So Fairfax had compounded its book value per share at 19.3%. Just a note, that includes dividends, and the share price compound also includes dividends. So book value, including dividends, up 19.3% compounded over that lengthy period of time since 1986. Just for a peer group, I've noted Markel and Berkshire Hathaway. They've compounded their book values at 18.9%. Now, I just want to draw the distinction that those are over different time periods. Certainly, Berkshire Hathaway is well over 50 years now. Markel went public just 1 year after Fairfax, so it's more or less the same. The share price, as I say, is compounded at 17.8%, and that compares to the peer group at 18.2%. So book value's actually grown a little bit more than the peer group, but the share price is compounded a little bit less than the peer group over the long term. So just to kind of set this up, where can you generate value in a property and casualty insurance company? Well, the first and most important is insurance underwriting, and by underwriting profitably. And then a related concept to that is how much float you can generate. And although I haven't shown it here, I'm going to also talk about reserve development over time, which isn't really a value creator, but you need to be comfortable that an insurance company is not understating its reserves. And as I hope to make the case to you shortly, Fairfax definitely has a history of strong reserve development and reserve redundancies. So then you get the investments, which is both interest and dividend income and capital gains from time to time. And then, of course, in the non-insurance businesses, you have the operating income and perhaps capital gains over time if you choose to sell one of those businesses. So let's walk through this. Insurance underwriting. So there's five-year increments over time other than the last 3 years. And you can see in the first 20 years of Fairfax's life, they had a combined ratio over 100. So under 100 means you're making money. Over 100 means you're losing money on underwriting. Now, I just would ask you to keep in mind this narrative. So in those early years, there's a couple of things going on. They're hitting their reserves pretty hard to bring the companies that they bought up to adequate reserve strength. Of course, interest rates were much higher during that time frame, so you could still make money because your investment portfolios nominally were doing better and generating a higher rate of return. But you can see for the last 15 odd years, they've been consistently below 100 in terms of their combined ratio. And that's an all-in, including catastrophe losses that emerge from time to time. And so I just ask you to keep in mind this narrative. If you went back to those early years, a lot of what was said about Fairfax was, boy, the investments are great and the investment team is terrific, but those insurance companies are average at best. And I'd ask you just to hold on to that narrative for a little bit later in this presentation. float generation, you can see that, you know, average float, you know, went from 22 million to 20 billion over time. And then I've just looked at the benefit of the float. So, you know, over time they've brought in their underwriting at profits. So the float had a negative cost, meaning they didn't pay anything for the float. And then I've just given you the average long-term Canada Treasury bond yield as a comparative. And so over the last 10 years, that financing differential was 3.5 percentage points per year. And then same numbers, just expressed a slightly different way. You can see the growth year by year using year-end numbers, not average float, and then just the float per share. So you have $834 a share in float, and you're getting the use of that money at no cost, as it's been the last several years, and then you can invest that money and get a return on that money. So that's a key part of how Fairfax and other property and casualty insurance companies generate and create value for shareholders. So just wanted to talk really, really quickly to reserve development because it's a related point. And you can see there over the last 5 years, Fairfax has had reserve redundancies. And so that's a good thing. That means that relative to the experience, not only were they adequately reserved, they actually were more than adequately reserved. And so there's no surprises, if you will, in terms of having a year of poor earnings because you're having to contribute more money to reserves to get rid of a deficiency. And through the first 9 months, they're at 2.7 points of reserve redundancy. So key takeaways on this underwriting component is, first thing I want to say is insurance rates are skyrocketing. And just to give you a sense of that, net premiums written increased 12.6% in the third quarter last year and 9.4% through the first 9 months of 2020. And this is almost all price related. And so for the first time in a long time, there's a hard market emerging in insurance, and it continues to firm. And even the renewal period here at January, a number of commentators have said that the prices are increasing even more. Fairfax has taken COVID losses of $536 million year to date. I just made a note there, 60% are incurred but not reported as of September 30th. So that means they've set up a reserve, but they haven't actually yet had a claim. So nobody knows. We don't know how that's all going to emerge over time, but they certainly, to the end of the third quarter, had taken a healthy level of reserves. And in fact, their actual claims experience was only 40% of what they reserved for. So the all-in combined ratio through the first 9 months of 2020 was 98.6. So when I say all-in, I'm including catastrophe losses and COVID losses. The core combined ratio, if you take out those two things, and you know, I'm not suggesting that those aren't real losses, but what I am suggesting is they don't come every year. And so I do like to look at the core ratio as well. And you can see that it was 10 points, basically 10 points lower at 89.2%. And then, as noted earlier, the favorable reserve development continues. So I think the picture on underwriting is very, very bright for Fairfax, and looks like we're in a hard market here. So that gets pretty exciting. In terms of investments, again, I've just similar to the underwriting numbers, I've given you 5-year average total return on investments. So think about that narrative I gave you on underwriting earlier, that in the early years they had, you know, combined ratios well above 100 and now they're below 100. It's almost the opposite story on their investments. So the period from 2011 to 2019, you know, you can see lower rates than they've had historically. And so now the narrative sort of changed. And, you know, I guess the point I'm trying to make here is that I don't think the narrative was right about the insurance company underwriting, because, you know, they were building out those business. And I don't think the recent investment performance is a fair narrative. But the narrative goes something like this today. It's 180 degrees from where it was 20 years ago. And the narrative is, oh boy, those insurance companies, are they ever great insurance platforms, but the investment team's not so hot. Well, as I say, I don't think either of those two scenarios are correct. And I would just note their since inception return on investments is 8%. And of course, understand, you know, they carry a lot of bonds. And so that's including the bond returns. So let's try and break this down a little bit further. I've looked at returns in the fourth quarter from some of their biggest investment holdings. Now, we need to draw a point of accounting here. I'm not distinguishing between mark-to-market equity investments or equity accounted or portfolio associate investments. So below 20% ownership in a company, they mark to market. 20 to 50 is equity accounted. To my way of thinking, it's all value creation. Even on the equity accounted investments, there's fair value disclosures at the end of every quarter based on mark to market accounting. So let me just walk you through some of the bigger ones. You know, Atlas, you can see there, has had a 285% gain. $1 million gain since the end of the third quarter. BlackBerry, 130. Eurobank, the Greek bank that they own about 30%, has gone from 38 euro cents to 58 euro cents, 280 million. You can go through the list. Most of the companies that are highlighted here, the prices have increased even more since year end. But you add those numbers up, and that comes to just over $1 billion in gains, representing just under $40 per share, all in US dollars. Now, of course, that's a pre-tax number, but you know, that's the amount of gain we're talking from their equity portfolio. And then just to drill down a little bit further, I've looked at controlling interests that they have that have a publicly traded stub, and I've looked at how that publicly traded stub has performed since September 30th. So Dextera has gone from 506 to 654 in Canadian dollars. I just want to stop and give you a data point there. When Dextera merged with Horizon North in March, the effective cost that Fairfax set up their controlling interest in Dextera was $3.17. So between March 31st and September 30th, it had gone from 331 to 506, and it's added a further gain in the fourth quarter, and that number is up again, as are, I believe, all of these companies, with the exception of Thomas Cook India, are all up since the end of 2020. So you can see there, Fairfax India had a gain. Helios Fairfax, the new Fairfax Africa combination with Helios, is up. Recipe International's up quite sharply. And you can see Thomas Cook India was up in the third quarter and just slightly down in the year to date. But again, that adds up to for almost $500 million or $18.50 a share. Again, pre-tax, of course, that's not going to go into book value because these are controlling interests on Fairfax's balance sheet. But to my way of thinking, examples of sort of intrinsic value creation that's taking place at the company. So between those two, their major investments, whether equity accounted or mark-to-market accounted, and their majority investments, those numbers add up to just under $60 per share on a $340 share price at the end of 2020. Fixed income portfolio, don't have much to say. So this is the maturity profile at September 30th. I would just highlight for you that this is a very short duration portfolio, 91% of the total bond portfolio of just under $17 billion is in 5 year or less maturities. So pretty low risk, all things considered. And then just one highlight. So they have Fairfax is undertaking and continues to undertake a strategic monetization program of some of their investments where appropriate to do so, and where it makes sense because it's allowing them to ring the cash register in a way that they think represents fair value. So I'll just highlight three recent transactions. Fairfax was partnered with the family of David Sokol and the actor Ryan Reynolds in a company called Davos Brands, the principal product of which was Aviation American Gin. That's been sold to Diageo. Roughly Fairfax's take was $60 million, and it was roughly a $20 million gain. However, that doesn't tell the whole story because there's up to $275 million in contingent payments based on how the company performs from here. And so the gains could be significantly more than the $20 million that Fairfax booked at the end of the third quarter. In the fourth quarter, they announced the sale of Riverstone Europe to the private equity firm CVC Partners. Fairfax had sold, they owned 100% of this company. They had partnered up with OMERS, who they are partnered up with on many other investments. OMERS is the Ontario Municipal Employees Retirement System pension plan. In the first quarter of 2020, they sold 40% of Riverstone Europe to OMERS. At that time, they were setting up the equity value of the remaining 60% at $605 million. The transaction to sell to CVC is for just under or approximately $750 million, Fairfax's 60% piece. And like the Davos sale, there's upwards of $275 million in contingent payments based on how the reserves and book value of Riverstone Europe sort themselves out over the coming years. So that's going to generate, when upon closing, $750 million or approximately $750 million US. And then there's the prospects for a significant contingent payment as well over time. And then the third one I just want to highlight to you, Fairfax owns a company in partnership with Power Corp that owns a number of sporting brands, Bauer and Easton. And they have undertaken to sell the Easton baseball brands to Rawlings. The deal hasn't closed yet. The price hasn't been disclosed, But in the third quarter conference call, Prem Watsa commented that the sale would generate a significant profit to Fairfax and Power Corp. So just trying to highlight for you that there's all sorts of pockets in this company that can lead to significant returns over time. And they're actively considering things that make sense for them to do. So a bit of a summary on the investment side. I just say, again, I showed you earlier, the fixed income portfolio is short duration and low risk, or relatively low risk. They haven't reached for yield. The equity investment portfolio is much, much improved, certainly from the bottom during the early days of the pandemic in March, April. And I tried to show you how much it had improved, at least among the key holdings in the fourth quarter of 2020. The majority investment prices are also much improved. And the strategic monetization of private investments is ongoing. Let's just take a real quick look at the financial position. And I apologize, this is a clunky slide with lots of data. You'll notice Fairfax thinks of things on a consolidated basis and an adjusted basis. And the reason I think adjusted is important here is you'll see that there's $2.1 billion in borrowings by the non-insurance companies at September 30th. Virtually all of that is non-recourse to Fairfax. So that does lower the indebtedness relative to total capital or equity quite significantly. And you'll see down at the bottom there at September 30th, net debt to total equity on an adjusted basis, 38%, 27% on a total capital basis, and 31% total debt to total capital. I would also just add that Fairfax drew down on credit lines when the pandemic hit. They have a lot of cash. You can see there almost $1.1 billion at the holdco. I would expect those ratios to improve either consolidated or adjusted quite significantly. As they pay down some of those lines they took out just for safety purposes during the pandemic. So does Fairfax Financial possess superior business economics? To my way of thinking, yes. I showed you the long-term track record, which is quite frankly phenomenal. I showed you they are underwriting and have been underwriting profitably for quite a considerable period of time, certainly on an all-in basis. But if you look at it on a core basis as well, very attractive underwriting or combined ratio numbers. Consistent float generation, you've seen how that number's grown over time. Conservative reserving, very important, so that you can have confidence in the accounting numbers that are being presented to you. Excellent long-term investment portfolio performance, even though admittedly the last few years haven't been up to their historical standard, but this is a very talented investment management team. And a strong financial position. So to my way of thinking, it checks a lot of the important boxes in terms of whether it has superior business economics or not. So my conclusion is clear. I'll leave it up to you to make your own judgment. So let's talk quickly. Does it have honest and capable management? So the first point I would make is Prem Watsa himself effectively owns 1.5 million over 1.5 million Fairfax common shares. So remember I said to you, we look for skin in the game. This is clearly skin in the game. Interestingly, he purchased an additional 483,000 shares in June for just under $150 $1,000. In poker terms, this is what we would describe, first of all, as a tell. He really thinks that the shares are attractively valued. And I would also say that in poker terms, this represents an all-in for Premwatsa on Fairfax. So that's a very encouraging sign. I would just make the note, and I've been racking my brains to think about other situations, but this is certainly the largest single share purchase by a sitting or existing CEO that I can recall in public markets. And I'm not saying it is the largest, but it's certainly the largest that I'm aware of. Equally importantly, Prem is compensated $600,000 in salary and has no options or bonuses. Other members of the executive team do. I think this is important. Prem walks with us as shareholders, and certainly I think the $600,000, given the size of the company, is totally reasonable, and it's been fixed for quite a number of years. Fairfax Capital Allocation Program, so I think they've done a really good job, you know, both buying and from time to time selling businesses. But I just highlight the active share repurchase program, including what they purchased in the fourth quarter. They have accumulated just under 2.1 million shares since the fourth quarter of 2017. And of course, I don't need to tell all of you that when you're buying under book value per share, it's immediately accretive to book value. So another important contributor to value creation. Company has an excellent board of directors. Would just highlight a couple to you. Bill McFarlane, the lead director at Fairfax, is the former managing partner of PwC in Canada. He was at one point the lead audit partner on the Fairfax audit. So I think he has a really good understanding of the financials at Fairfax. He's getting actively involved as the chairman of Dextera, to name one example of a company we talked about earlier. Other directors include Bill Weldon, William Weldon, the retired CEO of Johnson & Johnson, David Johnson, the former Governor General of Canada, who was a director before becoming Governor General of Canada and has returned to the fold, so to speak. Tony Griffith, who just stepped down as lead director, is a very talented businessman who continues to be a key advisor to Fairfax. So, and many, many others. I mean, the risk when you highlight a few is that you'll get a phone call from those who haven't been highlighted. I just think they have a really strong, diverse board, and I think it's a real strength for Fairfax. And then I would just comment, the guiding principles are a unique part of the corporate culture at Fairfax. They're listed every year in the annual report. They're on the website. I'm not going to read them all here for you today, but I think, you know, Prem spends a lot of his time talking to people throughout the organization and really trying to make those guiding principles part of the DNA of Fairfax and the Fairfax operations. And I think it shows over time. And I think it's an important part of what they're about. So does it have honest and capable management? Clearly skin in the game by Prem, but also by many others in senior management team. And they have an active employee share ownership program as well. Reasonable compensation practices. Capital allocation record and share repurchases. And again, highlight they've purchased quite a significant number of shares in the last few years, and the unique corporate culture. and should have included the board of directors as well in that. So to my way of thinking, again, I leave it up to all of you, but to my way of thinking, this is a company that's an exemplar in terms of having honest and capable management who think and act like shareholders. Can it be purchased at an attractive price? So just want to set the table here a little bit. Using that year-end price, and you know, full disclosure, it's gone up thus far in 2020, but I don't think it tilts the math inordinately in terms of what the returns and the attractive nature of the returns going forward. But 341, give or take, at the end of the year. For 2020, the share price was down almost 28% in US dollars. Again, a reminder, in US dollars, at the end of September, the book value was 442. Obviously, I expect that book value to grow in the fourth quarter when the year-end results are released. So the company trades based on the year-end and based on the September 30th book value at 77% or 0.77 times book. The peer group, Markel, Berkshire, trade at 1.29 times book. And again, the dividend yields 2.9%. So what if, and just want to lay out a few scenarios for you. What if Fairfax trades at current book value, and I'm using the September 30th number? That'll be a return of 29.7%. And by the way, this is without dividends, and they have announced they'll be paying their regular $10 dividend, annual dividend at the end of January. But, you know, Fairfax traded to current book value, the September 30th book value would be a return of 29.7%. What if it traded at the current peer group book value? That'd be a return of 67.3%. What if it grew its book value per share by 15%? And I'm not necessarily implying an annual objective. As you know, that's their annual objective. But I just wanted to illustrate, what if book went up 15% from the September 30th numbers and they traded to book value? That'd be a 49.2% return. If they grew book value by 15% and it traded to the peer group book value multiple, it would be a 92.4% return. So not saying these things are going to happen. I'm just saying, what if? And again, that's without dividends. So then I tried to look at it in a slightly different way. So again, book current market price, 341 or just under 341. Current book value, just over 442. What if it compounded at its stated rate to grow of 15% for 5 years? That would make the book value per share in 5 years, $899. Okay, what if it traded at that peer group multiple at that time of just under 1.3? That would make the market price $1,147, or an annual compounded rate return of 27.5%. And again, that's without dividends. The current dividend yield's 2.9%. You know, add that on, you know, you're looking 30% or over 30% compound from here. Not saying that's how it's going to unfold. I'm just saying, what if, and a way to maybe think about the company. And then the final what if for me is I believe that this company can earn more than $100 per share. And when I prepared this slide, I had a whole host of assumptions, and I just took it out because, quite frankly, it wasn't a readable slide. But I'll just lay out for you a couple of assumptions that I think are quite reasonable. So what if through the strong market over the next couple of years, they could get up to $20 billion a year in underwriting premium? And what if they could write at a combined ratio of 90? That would be underwriting profits of $2 billion. Okay, what if interest and dividend income could generate $500 million a year? Okay, they're above that rate right now on a run rate, but you know, they've had some higher coupon bonds roll over. And of course, we're in a lower interest rate environment today. And so they're, you know, they're reinvesting at lower rates. In the short run, the sale of Riverstone Europe will take away some investment assets. So to be conservative, I've said, what if they could generate dividend and interest income of $500 million? So that's $2.5 billion. And then I just said, what if realized capital gains and operating income from the non-insurance businesses could offset interest expense, corporate overhead at the head office, taxes and minority interests? Now, that to me is not a crazy number. And there's been many years where Fairfax has generated realized gains of, you know, $1 billion. And, you know, although the non-insurance companies have been running at a lower rate because of the pandemic, you know, they could easily generate $250 million in operating income, you know, give or take corporate overhead, interest expense, you know, tax, and depending on what rates apply in which areas, because this is a global company, you know, maybe $1 billion to $1.2 billion. So I don't think that's a crazy assumption. So now you're back to the $2 billion in underwriting profit, $500 million in dividend and interest income. What if the share count went to $25 million? Well, there's your $100. So I don't think this is crazy, a crazy way to think about this company. So you could earn $100 a share, and it's trading at year end at $340. So just in summary, very quickly, I think this is a great business run by great people, available at a great price. And John, with that, I'll turn it back to you for questions.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for this wonderful investment thesis on a company that I'm sure many of our members are quite familiar with, and perhaps one of the rare, still reasonably valued companies in the market today. Jeff, I'd be curious to hear how you think about capital allocation at Fairfax going forward.
Well, in terms of the insurance platform, they have a widely diversified platform. I don't think they need to make any big acquisitions from here. So I'm not saying it couldn't happen, but I don't think, I think they've got a good platform. So on the insurance side, it wouldn't strike me that, you know, it would be modest amounts of money to maybe buy something that was smaller, that was a tuck-in. Of course, they are partnered. They do not own 100% of Allied World today, and they're committed to owning 100% and have, you know, an arrangement over time with their partners, OMERS and AIMCO, to buy out the rest of Allied World. So I would think that's for sure that's going to happen. So that'll take some capital. But other than that, on the insurance side, I think they're in pretty good shape. They, by the way, the template for that, they owned Brit Insurance in partnership with OMERS. They completed the purchase of the last piece of that in 2020. So they now own 100% of Brit. So of those core insurance companies I showed you earlier, you know, the only one they don't own 100% of is Allied World. And there's a plan over time for them to get to 100%. So on the non-insurance business, that's just more opportunistic. My own view a little bit is that, you know, perhaps this strategic monetization is evidence that, you know, they had made a lot of purchases and, you know, maybe it become just slightly unwieldy for them. And, you know, they just want to get back to basics on the non-insurance business side of things. And certainly Prem highlighted in the recent conference call that they were not done with the strategic monetization. What they might sell, of course, will depend on what opportunities are presented to them. But I do think over time they might see that as a source of capital. But I also just say to you, you know, they're great investors, they're very opportunistic, and if the opportunity to buy something comes along, they will certainly do so. I also just point out they've been very successful at making, you know, large, not controlling purchases in companies, but becoming a large strategic shareholder. And, you know, we talked about Atlas, for example, earlier. That's the old C-SPAN. You know, they own 40% plus of that company. They own roughly 30% of Eurobank, the larger, or the bank in Greece, based in Greece. So, you know, most of it would be opportunistic in that way. And then in terms of capital allocation, I fully expect them to continue to repurchase shares as they get as capital becomes available to do so. Of course, right now, one of the things operationally is insurance is in a hard market. It's probably the highest and best use of capital to make a return for shareholders. So, you know, they're not pulling money back from any of their insurance companies through dividends. And in actual fact, in a couple of cases, they've increased the amount of capital available to those insurance companies to write insurance in this favorable period. So that would be the other big lever that could be pulled one way or the other in terms of capital allocation.
Well, that's wonderful. I will leave it there, Jeff. I would just encourage our members to feel free to follow up with you with their own thoughts or questions. Thank you so much for being a part of Best Ideas 2021 and taking the time to share your insights into Fairfax.
And thank you, John, and happy to take any follow-up questions that any of the members have. And just again, I think your service is more important than ever for all of us in the investment business who are either on forced stay-at-home or voluntary work-from-home regimes. It's nice to have a community of people like the MOI global community to tap and to fall upon for support. And so again, I just thank you for everything, and keep up the really great work that you're doing.
Thank you so much, Jeff. I truly appreciate it. Take care. Goodbye for now.
Bye now.